This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel talks about being in the room for negotiations to bring Brandt Industries and 300 jobs to a plant between Hudson and Normal.
Well, I think I was in that group because we are the largest taxing body. With that said, Unit 5 probably has a very strong influence with the other governing bodies.
Why Daniel urged his board to vote against the immediate pocketbook. Plus, Ryan Denham talks with State Representative Dan Brady about the fall veto session.
And a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It was a tough veto session this fall for Governor Bruce Rauner. 15 of his 39 vetoes were overridden by lawmakers. Prior to this year, Rauner had been overridden just once. One of those bills was the so-called debt transparency bill, which was being pushed hard by Democratic Comptroller Susana Mendoza. It would require greater disclosure of state finances. State Representative Dan Brady voted against the bill originally when it passed, but in late October, the Bloomington Republican was part of a unanimous vote to override Governor Rauner's veto on the bill. During this veto session recap, Brady talks to GLT's Ryan Denham about why there were so many veto overrides this time around.
What I experienced more so than ever before in a veto session was individual elected officials personally lobbying legislators, whether that be the comptroller, whether that be our attorney general, and asking them to take a second look at some of the pieces of legislation that had been either outright vetoed by Governor Rauner or mandatorily vetoed. And so that was something that was different. And then I guess a big takeaway that was in the second part of veto session was the sexual harassment side of things that came out and caused a flurry of activity and actually legislation that became part of a seminar that we ended up taking before he left Springfield. So from that standpoint, that was something that moved very quickly. From the veto session standpoint, it was one that I think there was more involvement from those elected officials in particular that had legislation that had been vetoed by the governor and were of different parties.
Well, let's stick with the Debt Transparency Act just to catch our listeners up. This is something that was supported by Democratic Comptroller Susana Mendoza. It would require state agencies to basically report the monthly amount of bills that are being held, liabilities that are being appropriated, liabilities that may have late interest penalties on them. State agencies currently do this once a year in October. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you actually opposed that bill originally, but then took a second look at it. Were part of that unanimous vote to override?
It was.
Why was that?
Well, I think that it always makes a difference when you review things and some of the things that may have changed at the time from when that legislation first was vetoed in the aspect that the governor did. And then hearing, you know, the other side of the story, very seldom do you get the other side of the story from the standpoint of an individual. As in this case, Comptroller Mendoza, and the importance to the legislation. Now, I hope that's truly the case, but to have more transparency and have it explained in a different way in addressing some of the specific parts of what the governor's veto message was, that helps for you to at least, you know, step back and pause and look at things. And this was one of those cases. And so I think that from that standpoint, you know, and unless you have the opportunity to hear from the other people involved and the other people that are specific and may have specifics that you don't have in a message, I think that was important.
So that was one of 15 vetoes of Governor Rauner's that was overridden during the veto session. So why do you think that was? So why did we see so many? Because previous to this year, Rauner had just been overridden, I think, once.
Right.
So I think what do you change? You mentioned, you know, lobbying by individuals. individual office holders like Comptroller Mendoza and others. Was that it, or were there other factors at play here, do you think?
Well, I think that's a big part of it. I can't remember a veto session where an elected official that had legislation that had been vetoed, as our Attorney General, as the Comptroller, did personally contacting and reaching out and trying to explain what differed in the veto message and what they saw differently about the legislation. And quite frankly, both of those particular pieces of legislation, I had very little constituent input. In other words, I did not hear from any large sector of my constituency, but yet I heard from those who sponsored the legislation or helped to write the legislation and the need for that legislation. And in the particular case of the students' bills of right, if you will.
And this is the other bill that you supported a veto override on, right?
That's correct. In particular, what I think changed from the time that the governor's message had come out on that particular bill was that, as he cited in his message, the federal oversight, the federal government responsibility in this particular loan sector. But after listening to Attorney General Madigan and some others that helped with the legislation, and the bill sponsor did a fine job to show that from the time that veto message has changed, what has changed in the federal government towards student loans, and that there may in fact be less regulation. And what struck me also was the emphasis that was put on in the student loan sector of things, the lack of really education, what students know they're getting themselves into as far as this loan goes, and the focus that they're being driven into. There's a lot of different categories, and they're driven into more of a category where what they're paying is dealing with just the interest. And it's not going after the principal. And so looking at that, listening to some other input, caused me to think differently about it. Because we want to do what we can, obviously, for students and their protection and the least amount of debt when they come out of university.
What do you think of this storyline that sort of emerged out of veto session that basically it's a signal of Governor Rauner's decreased power as it comes to corralling Republican lawmakers? Do you think that's a viable explanation for what was going on with the number of veto overrides that took place?
I think that the longer you're in a position such as governor, and you have to make decisions, and you take action, there are going to be those that don't like the action that you took. And I think that plays a big part of it. Your popularity begins to wear off from the standpoint of making those type of decisions. Then you also have the factor of, in our case, a House Republican caucus that has been supportive on as many fronts as possible. Not all fronts with the governor. We're not always going to agree with the governor on everything, as we don't agree with the other side on everything, but where we can find that common ground. So I think that in part, you know, the issues themselves, how they've been handled, is in part responsible that the governor had a different scorecard when it comes to overrides this time around in the veto session.
Let's talk higher education. You and State Senator Chapin Rose came out a month or so ago pushing a bill that would create the Higher Education Strategic Centers of Excellence Plan. Can you explain what that would do?
We have had long-standing discussions on the overall operation of the finances of higher education in the state of Illinois. And I think you'll see more activity surrounding changes, in particular, some type of a funding formula that may mimic what was done in K-12 education most recently. But one thing is for sure that we found common agreement on was that we agreed the outward migration of students not going to Illinois universities, we have to look at something. And so Senator Rose and I had come up with the idea with other input, and quite frankly, input from some students that had testified at task force committee hearings over the years, that said one of the things you could do to help students stay in Illinois when it comes to higher education is make the process easier. And one of those areas was looking at a common app that when you would apply to one of our state universities, that that would be good for all of our state universities. Another component of the bill, which is controversial, is if you're a B student in the state of Illinois and you don't get your first choice to go into and be accepted at one of our state universities, there's guaranteed placement somewhere else. And then there's other parts of the bill. One other area, though, is trying to involve the State Board of Higher Ed with more of a enforcement side of criteria for if the university is going to go into a new program, a new school. What's the real need for that? And what type of criteria should we have before we are creating more programs that maybe could be handled at a different university better because of their background, their mission statement, their location, whatever the case may be. And so the bill has a number of aspects that focuses on what can we do better for Illinois and what can we do to stop this outward migration of students. And so one of the things was, you know, making an easier universal process to try and apply to get in. And then if we've got a decent GPA and good grades, give us the opportunity to go somewhere else in the state of Illinois. Those are things that I think a lot of folks have some common feeling about. Now, the rest of the bill is going to take some work, but what we want to do is we want to try and identify in the state what our universities are the best at, and then take it from there to make sure our universities all can keep going. But the financial picture of the pie is not going to be any easier in years to come. And identifying those special areas, those special degrees, things that a university does best, we'd like to see if we couldn't get some more criteria and input from the State Board of Higher Ed. And I think you'll see some other things coming in next spring session that's going to look at higher ed as well. We hope to take proactive steps before universities are forced into things that they don't want to have to consider.
And these higher education institutions, they would probably argue that they're getting less and less funding from the state. So why should they be subject to more and more oversight or evaluations of what they're doing sets them apart in some way? And,
right.
What would be your response to that?
My thoughts would be this, that we know one thing from a financial side of things, that there's not enough to go around to our universities. And having some type of funding-based formula based on your performance, based on your number of students, based on things that should be part of a criteria, may help those, all while looking at others to maybe possibly change that. If this school of fine arts area is not your cup of tea and your numbers aren't there, maybe we should look at something that you do very well, whether it be architecture, whether it be aviation, whether it be something else. And maybe we should put the focus on that in a performance based funding formula to help the universities to be able to make sure that those universities stay open and continue to provide the best they can in maybe a certain area of higher education.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here in studio with State Representative Dan Brady, Republican from Bloomington. Representative Brady, let's shift over to the opioid crisis. Nationally, this has been declared a public health emergency. Here in McLean County, we've seen the number of overdose deaths jump to 33 this year already. It's more than double what we saw in 2016. There were just 10 opioid-related deaths in October alone. Folks who may not realize this, you were a former McLean County coroner yourself. So what do you think about when you hear these stats, particularly what's happening here in McLean County?
Well, obviously it's alarming to think of county of McLean. In my tenure as county coroner, that opiate problem was not there, or it was extremely dormant and nowhere near the level that it is today. I was part of the first opiate task force that the House undertook before the governor's task force. And when we got into, you know, Narcan and working with the EMS and police and fire and so many other areas. But to hear the stories from across the state, the ease, the how inexpensive, and how this also a lot of times starts from a standpoint of being on some other type of medications, painkillers, et cetera, that comes out of it. So I think that the role from the state side of things is to partner more than ever with our local municipalities who've seen it on the front lines. One of the things out of our task force, as I said, was Narcan, was obviously grant funding, education, and all the things that that are important. But we have to prioritize. I think we're the center of these deaths and overdose are occurring, and what can be done best with the municipalities that are there from a state role.
Let's pivot to the election then, Dan. So you've got some opponents this time around, which is something that that hasn't happened in a little while. Realtor David Paul Blumenschein has announced plans to challenge you in the Republican primary, and then Democrat Ben Webb just recently said that he's going to be running in your district, would hope to face you in the general election should he get through the primary. You haven't had a general election opponent, I don't think, since 2006, mm-hmm. a primary challenge since 2000. So why do you think you're being challenged now?
Well, first off, I respect the elective process. I think anybody who knows me knows that how hard I work. If there's others that think they can do a better job, they can step up to the plate. The reality is I have a proven record of public service, of dedicated service to this constituency, my constituency, to the state. And so I like helping people cut through their issues of red tape with state government. And so I, again, respect the democratic process. There are those that would probably not be able to tell you the numerous pieces of legislation that I've passed, but they would be able to tell you what I did for them when they contacted my office. And I think for those who want to use spin words and those who want to talk about, their different take on things in Springfield, that's great. And I look forward to the process. I've had, with the help of the electorate, the privilege to serve. I've had the ability to beat Republicans, Democrats, Green Party, and so I love a challenge.
That's State Representative Dan Brady, a Republican from Bloomington, talking with GLT's Ryan Denham about the recent veto session and his own reelection bid in 2018. You can find more election coverage on our website, WGLT.org, in the news section under Election 2018.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a follow-up from John Norton's examination of the resurgent live music scene in Bloomington. Normally talks with the owner of the Castle Theater. The Economic Development Incentive Package to bring Canadian manufacturer Brandt Industries to McLean County took another step with the McLean County Board approval last night. On Monday, it passed the Unit 5 School Board, though not with much happiness, since Unit 5 will give up the largest gain from the plant and the 300 jobs it would bring to the location between Hudson and Normal. There was a point in the Unit 5 School Board debate over the Brandt Industries tax incentive proposal that it appeared the board would turn it down. Board members were understandably worried about the cost and being asked to give up revenue. At that point, Superintendent Mark Daniel stepped in and talked about the importance of maintaining enrollment and the prospect of several hundred new households for the district. Why did you choose that moment?
Well, I think you were very perceptive, and I felt the same in regards to I wanted to make sure the board had all the information that I had based my decision on. And enrollment is a key in today's funding formula. And to be honest, we're still trying to understand the funding formula. We haven't received any additional funds at this point. How are they going to calculate? We know it now is going to be October 1st, a key date, and March 1st is a key date. That is very different than in the past where we're on average daily attendance, number of minutes, number of hours for students. So it really does boil down to what is the enrollment? How does enrollment then, how do you, as students transfer and so forth? And quite frankly, my position is if you have jobs, you have then families, and families have children at school age. So those all very much link. Can I give you exact numbers? No. But I thought the board needed to hear that, and I'll be honest as well. I look around in different communities, and those that do not have manufacturing jobs, do not have jobs that are coming to their community, and I'm going to say manufacturing jobs specifically, because service sector positions offer low wage and are not, they're not, should we say, you can't earn a livable wage. We're looking at companies that are providing a livable wage, and I think it's important for all of us to come together. Now, retrospect, I would like to talk to our board. Matter of fact, I think this is going to be an event that's going to happen where we're going to lay out what are abatements, what are acceptable abatements, and what is the negotiation process. Personally, I'm a superintendent of schools. For me to be sitting down with a billionaire talking about negotiating an abatement, I think that's probably left to for those people who are best suited to do that. We had to do that.
Why were you in that room?
Well, I think I was in that group because we are the largest taxing body of the group. And with that said, Unit 5 probably has a very strong influence with the other governing bodies. Not saying complete influence, but saying an influence.
Well, you set the example because you are the biggest.
We are the largest. 66% of that funding comes to Unit 5 schools.
And if you give up the $400,000, $500,000 per year, if all of the jobs develop as hoped, at least at first, some of those jobs are going to be a drain on the district because
Absolutely. They
will have kids.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, that's where the board is. And again, for us, it's about, again, if you're looking at $400,000 over a 10-year period, not a year period. So, you know, I was looking at this, you know, as we're sitting there negotiating, I thought to myself, you know, I like the Rivian contract for when it passed. But I felt as if there needed to be some tangible connection between their community partnerships. And so we did ask the 50% coming back to Unit 5 schools and to Heartland Community College. And that is, if you will, you have an abatement, but I'm asking for, if you will, a rebatement. How are you going to bring that money back to us? And I know that's a little fuzzy right now. And I just met with principals this morning and said, hey, start making that list. Because the first year, we're looking at really $40,000. And then if you bring back the 50% rebate or rebatement.
20 grand is not a big.
You're looking at 20 grand.
Yeah.
But 20 grand is still 20 grand.
And what do you think that will pay for?
So these are some of the things that we discussed. And we discussed, for instance, you know, we have an IT program running right now for computer science for students entering our ninth grade and then finishing with an associate's degree with IT and computer science. Well, what about manufacturing? What about engineering? So those are areas that immediately I go to and I say, you know what? We have Project Lead the Way. We have we definitely have professional development expenses that our teachers are involved with. Could you support that? We have equipment that is needed in those courses. Could you support that? Could you support maybe even a manufacturing track? And let's talk about that. And even to scholarships for students. Now, I will agree that is not to sit down and say exactly $20,000. We're going to have to work through how to keep track of that and monitor that. But That is something we'll do, and I felt comfortable with Mr. Semple in regards to his responses that he will follow up. The CEO of the plant, the president of the plant, president of the industry of Brand Industries. I felt comfortable with his responses in regards to that's what we do, that's what we're part of, and he spoke about the 360 degree commitment. That if you do well by others, they'll do well by you. So thinking that there is truly a community partnership, and I feel comfortable with Rivian as well, but I'm anxiously awaiting to see what happens with Rivian, just as we all are.
How close were you to saying no deal or deal? Was it a close call for you?
I think it was a very close call for all of us. I mean, this, we have been working on this probably for, when I became directly involved, probably 4 or 5 weeks ago. Before, it was really the EDC working through that with, and Kyle Hamm and Mike Grady working through that. And but then it got to some specifics, and we had requested that the EDC, that's one lesson we did learn with Rivian, come to us before we get to this level of, and then it's presented, and here you go, take it or leave it. So we wanted to be involved when it came close. And if it was going to directly impact us, we want to be part of that discussion on an early phase. Well, what I've discovered in the world of business is you do bargain until the last moment. And then if finally a deal is reached, almost always there's a time constraint. I don't like that time constraint. I don't like to be told, you know, I got to make a decision by Wednesday the 15th.
But boy, oh boy, that's hard for public bodies.
It is hard for public bodies.
And absolutely, it is a little unfair for taxpayers to expect that to be okay.
Well, again, that is part of the abatement process that we don't like. So let's set down some protocol in regards to the people who are in this process.
Why such a time constraint? Why couldn't it have been decided earlier?
Well, I think he was working on, or to be honest, we kept on going back and going back and going back. And I think you asked the question, was this deal at any time in jeopardy? And I'll say it was up to the, and we were working on this even Sunday evening at 8:30. Did we have a draft of a contract? Absolutely. You know, we provided that to our board Friday afternoon when we felt comfortable with the contract. We had listed some talking points, but there are still some sticky points to that. One of the sticky points was the wage piece. We were pretty much settled on the numbers, which we thought were very conservative numbers. We think they're going to be much better. The numbers will be better than the 300 that we're seeing in 7 years. But we knew that we had to attach numbers to this contract, and we need to have livable wages. And as such, we had tossed that around a lot of ways. From the perspective, and I'm not going to speak for Mr. Simple and Brand Industries, but they're a private company, and they want to stay private. And they wanted to ensure that we were going to continue to be, to allow that to happen. But our argument was, when you go for public funds and abatements, now you're opening yourself up. You're going to have to expose some of that.
So what was the wage range on which the negotiations centered?
So we sort of were fluctuating between, do you want to take an average of workers? Do you want to take what it is in Bloomington normal based on the Labor Bureau labor statistics? And we're open to those, but it took some time to get that to that point where they felt, as in Brandt Industries, felt comfortable saying, okay, we agree. We'll do this by occupation, in other words, by position, and what is the mean salary or mean wages in those areas? And they agreed to that, which we thought, okay, we agree to that too. We're ready to move on. But that was a bone of contention, as was how much are you going to invest in that plant or plants. And you may have heard last night, we're looking at, I want to say $21 to $23 million. And that is not or should not be towards the actual purchase of the plant. That's new equipment going into the building, i.e. and expanding the properties. So, and there are a lot of things as you get into that phenomenon. I've learned a few things. By the way, land and ag, there are two adjoining properties, adjacent properties, where our total property tax receipts are approximately $400, a little bit less than $400. Those were ones where we said, hey, we'll give you 100% abatement on those. Those are, but if you expand those, because that means you're expanding your plant and that means you're expanding your employee base. We were good with that. But the plant itself, we're wanting to hold true to that, saying, hey, You know, first offer was, I want 100% 5 years. And we said, well, wait a minute. You know, we're looking at places like Rivian and places like Mitsubishi who invested multiple millions of dollars, multi-million dollars in plants. We're not comfortable with that arrangement, but can you stagger that? Can we take a percentage of it? So that's where the percentages came through. But I'll tell you, that was a stressful time for us as we're going through that process, frustrating for us, but I think it was also frustrating for Brandt and Brandt Industries. But we've come to an agreement, and if it's been frustrating for me, I know it's, as you said earlier, I think it's frustrating for our board, and we heard that last night. You know, companies coming to Illinois, these are taxes that go to very basic needs. Basic needs being student, education, road systems, libraries, fire, and so on. So
it's hard to give that up.
It's hard to give that up because it's not that much that we receive from it, but it's so important for us.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Mark Daniel, the superintendent of Unit 5 Schools, who was part of the negotiating team that reached a development agreement with Brandt Industries to abate taxes in return for significant investment in an agricultural implement plant north of the Twin Cities and the creation of potentially several hundred jobs over 6 to 7 years. What was the time constraint? Why couldn't there have been a week's worth of or 2 weeks worth of public discussion of this, followed by a special meeting of a different timed special meeting of these taxing bodies?
Well, we were told that they needed to close on the property this Wednesday. So that was the timeline. Otherwise, they were going to move to a different estate, most likely.
They set that deadline.
That's the time. That was why the timeline was there.
Was that a negotiating tactic, or were they serious?
Well, I think everything's a negotiating tactic.
Okay.
I'll just leave it at that.
Could you have renegotiated that point to allow for more and fuller public discussion?
Could have been. I think that would be, again, what is the risk associated with that? Understanding, too, that the state and the EDGE grant that they received, we don't know exactly what the amount of money is from the state, but we do know that there's been some funding given based on their meeting goals and certain numbers, that the state is also involved.
Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel. Heartland Community College is the next taxing body to take up the incentive tax abatement package to bring Brandt Industries and 300 jobs to McLean County.
As the pace of news quickens, Morning Edition moves faster.
That my service in the Senate will conclude at the end of my term in early January.
As the story gets more complex, we step back and we break it down.
The grand jury indictment accuses them of working on behalf of...
And when you need a break, we take a breath.
Snoop Dogg stars in a new version of The Joker's Wild, calibrated to speak...
Be ready for your day. Wake up to Morning Edition tomorrow.
Hear Morning Edition Monday through Friday, now starting at 4 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Community Players presenting Sister Act, a divine musical comedy nominated for 5 Tony Awards in 2011 and based on the hit film starring Whoopi Goldberg. Preview Thursday, November 2nd and performances Fridays through Sundays through November 19th. Tickets at communityplayers.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up on the show, a bright green holiday tradition. Many local musicians and fans credit the Castle Theater for a resurgence in the Bloomington Normal music scene. The once dormant movie house resurfaced as a music venue in 2011 under the guidance of new owner Rory O'Connor. GLT's John Norton sat down with O'Connor on the second floor of the castle to discuss his purchase and why he thought it would work as a live music room.
I was an owner in the radio station, The Whip. I think I was an owner for maybe 8 years prior to that. And I think right before Ben Slotkey had bought the castle, I was thinking that it might be a good idea. I was building homes at the time. I was a home builder here in Bloomington. And so having worked years with the radio station and doing shows that supported the radio station, when the housing crisis hit and the demand for new homes, you know, shrank, I'm like, you know, I got to do something else. And so why not do something related to the radio station and some experience I already had? And so then I revisited the castle, and I knew it was closed at the time, and I tracked down the bank that, you know, was in possession of the castle at that time, came in, looked at it, showed it to a couple friends. They thought I was crazy. I didn't, though. So made an offer to the bank, and we were able to acquire, you know, the castle at that time in April of 2010.
I was not alone, I believe, in thinking, boy, that's a great idea for the castle. It's great to bring new music in on a regular basis. It'll last 6 to 9 months, and just like any other venue, it's going to be gone. How did you know that this was going to work?
Well, I don't know if I knew it was going to work, but I knew that the space was good. My presumption was it was underserved. There wasn't a lot going on in Peoria at the time. Wasn't a lot going on in Springfield. Of course, you had the canopy and some stuff going on in Champaign, but once again, our geography and, you know, being able to draw from all of Central Illinois for what we tried to build as a regional nationwide room just made a lot of sense to me. And, you know, at the time, Clearview Church was in here renting, so, you know, we had a little bit of revenue from that. But, you know, I did it on a flyer. You know, nothing risked, nothing gained.
How much have you put into renovating the castle when you bought it? You know, I don't know if you want to give a dollar figure, but, you know, how much work has put into it?
The renovation that was done by Ben when he opened it was really good. I mean, it was top notch. So we had to modify it. We had to take out some structure. We had to add some protective railings and some countertops, and of course the sound and light systems. And we just invested a bunch of money in lights last year to try to get up to speed with, you know, moving lights and just we've worked hard at the sound part of it with, you know, sound dampening things on the walls. You know, all rooms are a little live. Ours was probably too live when we first opened up, so we've done some sound treatments in the room. It's not very hard to spend a couple $100,000 to get up and running in a music venue with sound and lights. You know, we've been open 7 years, so the lighting upgrade was good. Next couple years, we're going to have to, you know, probably do some upgrades to the sound system just because of the life expectancy of that product. So there is no shortage of places to spend money at the castle. I mean, it's constant.
How has the audience that comes to see shows, how has that evolved since you first opened up?
It's constantly changing. You know, with our market size and our demographic, you know, we still try to be as eclectic as possible. We're probably a little less eclectic than when we first opened. At some point, you have to sort of find your niche in the marketplace. You know, we do have competition in all the other towns.
Well, could you address what you thought that niche was at the beginning and how it's evolved to what it is now? Is there a way to put it in words?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, my strength when I first started, of course, was what we were doing at the WIP radio station, and that was more in the Americana, you know, blues, rootsy rock kind of formats. When we first started, you know, John Ugolini from Kickstand in Chicago, you know, liked the room, and he brought kind of a more of an indie vibe to it. So we worked with him because it was a strength of his. So we were open to working with a couple of guys on the outside that knew things that we didn't know. Jason Williams, that works for us full time now in booking, he knew rock music that we didn't know. So we leaned on them for that too. I like a lot of different kinds of music, but you really know what you know, and you can't act like you know it all because you just don't. So,
well, it does seem rock, indie rock, what some kind of rock is your core, but you're heavy metal, you're hip hop at times, you really can be all over the place, but rock is your core, it sounds like.
I think so. It's music that excites. We would love to do more country than we're doing. Country music is a different animal altogether. You know, we try to grab things, but the venue down in Springfield specializes in that, and they've got a good crowd for country, and the agents seem to want to be in a room that is always country and known as a country place. So that genre has been probably the most challenging for us, because I know we're underserving that in this market, and we try hard, but It is a little tough for us at the moment to try to grab that stuff.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton on the second floor of the Castle Theater in downtown Bloomington. I'm talking with owner Rory O'Connor. I'm going to ask you now about what a lot of people in town are saying, and that is, since you came on the scene in 2011, that the Castle Theater has been at least a catalyst for rejuvenating the music scene in Bloomington Normal. Is there any accuracy to that? How do you look at it, Rory?
Well, I'm sure we've had the positive impact. You know, you just, you know, have a club that's trying to, we'd be open every night if it was possible. You know, we just would. So we try to be that venue. I think it takes a number of venues, though, to really be a vibrant music scene, because our room is 800. Sometimes if you're a new band trying to put together, even if you're talented, and it's, you got to build your audience a little bit, and you got to start from the ground up. And I know Chris Goldwitzer is going to open up a place downtown here, and hopefully that can help that build that music scene too. You know, we're good friends with, you know, Chicago Farmer Cody and Ed Anderson and those guys. Danny Hubbard, of course, has been a mainstay here, and you know, they consider the Castle home, so that says something about the local music scene. But it takes more, and it takes more people coming out. You know, we're trying to change culture here a little bit. I mean, it's a town that didn't have a club for a lot of years, and it takes a little bit of a culture shift to kind of embrace that. And so we try to make it as comfortable as possible here. I don't really think much about taking credit for anything. You know, I'm more like, what can we do to make the fan experience better? I always feel like it's my job. It's not the job of the fans. I got to make everybody's experience here be as good as possible, and that's from being a clean place, a place that sounds good, a place that's comfortable to see a show, a place that's safe. I mean, we take all those things into consideration all the time, and you know, it's our business, and so we have to be as good as we can be.
Okay, final question. What did I miss that you wanted to talk about with the Castle Theater?
It's funny, your point about, you know, you looked at it and you probably didn't think it had much chance, and I showed a couple of friends and they were like, you're crazy. And we've got a pretty strong intern program here with ISU, and so we have interns every semester, and you know, I talk to them like once a semester, just like a parting type thing, and I just try to tell them, pursue their dreams. There's all kinds of barriers to trying to execute something, and we're trying to grow our business. I mean, this was a step out, but you know, I was going through a challenging time as a home builder, but, you know, a good idea, there's money, you know, available for good ideas.
Castle Theater owner Rory O'Connor speaking with GLT's John Norton. Local musicians, fans, and venue owners say the Castle has been one reason for the resurgence in the local music scene. You can read and listen to that story at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Before you stuff that turkey, you can deck the halls at a beloved Bloomington Normal tradition that kicks off the holiday season while it helps young people in our community. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
For 24 years, the Baby Fold has hosted the Festival of Trees, featuring a wide variety of decorated trees and other Christmas decor in a fundraiser that not only raises dollars, but raises awareness of the needs of children and families. The festival is this Friday through Sunday out at the Interstate Center in Bloomington. Amy Beam is the Vice President of Development and Public Relations at the Baby Fold, and she says this year the theme for the festival is the heart of giving.
But we always think of the true theme as the Baby Fold. We want everyone to tie the Festival of Trees to serving kids and families, and we hope the community understands when they come out to support and enjoy the festival, they're really supporting children.
Well, tell me about some of the programs that are helped by the Festival of Trees.
Well, the Baby Fold serves over 1,000 kids and families every year, and we have programs that range from foster care to adoption support to specialty schooling through our Hammett School programs, and even early intervention initiatives that have been proven to prevent child abuse and neglect. So we're very proud of what's going on.
So, of course, you need funding for that, and that's
yes.
Why you have something massive like the Festival of Trees.
It is massive. massive and exciting. we like to think of it, this as one of our ways to give back to the community. We know people like to start their holiday season like this, and it's something that we can do to really pull everybody together the way they've pulled behind us.
It's a really big festival. Yes. It takes place over several days.
Yes.
Let's talk about some of the events we can expect to see.
We're just very excited this year. We have so many great things going on. Professional designers who have created beautiful trees that are going to be absolutely everywhere.
So can people bid on these trees or buy them outright? How does that work?
Absolutely. Everything that they see, it looks like decorations in a beautiful enchanted forest, but everything is for sale. So it's like a huge silent auction. There's trees and wreaths and table settings all in the Christmas spirit, and you can put a bid on any one of those things, or you can choose just to buy it outright for the buy it now price, and all of that money goes back to the baby fold. Don't buy any Christmas decorations until you've been there to see what you might want to get, because, again, it helps our kids and families, and we're growing and we're expanding and we're really investing in the lives of children. So the proceeds that come from the Festival of Trees will go a long way to helping us do our job.
Are there certain themes with the trees, with the decor?
There's a variety of themes. We've got sports teams and just traditional holiday fare and everything in between. They are creative as the minds of our artists. We have a design committee that dedicates nearly an entire year every year to thinking about the kinds of things that they could do. And they even go to a seminar at Jeffrey Allen's to learn what's cutting edge as far as tree decor goes and how to make it look very special so that when people do purchase these things, they look very nice in their homes.
You also have an opening day breakfast.
Yes, which is something different for us. We've traditionally done a Thursday night event, but we're always trying to keep things new and fresh, and we've come to understand how easy it is for our community to get to breakfasts and how much they enjoy those. So we thought we'd just give it a try this year, and anyone who comes to our opening day breakfast will have an exclusive ticket that will allow them to get first look at all of the trees and wreaths, and I'm going to make some special announcement about good things that are happening at the baby fold, and then they'll get to look around in advance of the public coming in. The breakfast is from 7 to 9, but the public won't be allowed in until 9.
There's also Avanti's Family Night.
Yes, Avanti's Family Night is one of our favorites. And we have not only delicious food from Avanti's for families, but we also have this excellent bluegrass band. And they're going to be playing Christmas music, and I think that people will really enjoy hearing them. They're called New Legacy. And last year when they came to us, they were about ready to go out on tour, and they were going to kick off and just do a little practice at the festival. And they were phenomenal. So we were lucky to get them back this year.
There's also a tradition, breakfast with Santa.
Yes. You have to come see Santa on Saturday morning at the Festival of Trees. That is where he lives every year on Saturday morning. And also the kids will get to hear great entertainment by Julie Kay, who dances and sings on stage for the kids and blows bubbles. And they get so excited. It's one of my favorite times.
You also have a Heart of Festival Luncheon. Now, what is that?
Now, that's something a little bit different. We haven't done this in a while, but we want people to come out on Sundays and enjoy just a traditional family-style meal with us and enjoy the festival before it ends. The auction that day ends at 2:30, so you have until 2:30 on Sunday to bid. You can enjoy the festival until 4 p.m., but it's a good chance to bring your family out, come out, and see us before we close.
Amy, we in the state of Illinois had to deal without a budget for quite some time.
Yeah, I noticed that.
and of course, it was impacting all sorts of organizations.
Absolutely.
Including the Baby Fold. How does the Festival of Trees help out and making sure you guys can still do what you need to do?
It has become something that is an important part of our annual budget, not only the funds that are raised, but the publicity surrounding it and all of the community members talking about the festival in conjunction with the Baby Fold helps us spread the good news about what we do. So there's the money that we raise there that we very much count on, and also the after effect that's very positive for us and brings people to our cause. So we really count on it as much as the community counts on coming to the event and enjoying it. I would just like to thank the community for all their support. It has been a rocky time for so many with a budget impasse, but we've come out of it in such a positive fashion, and we're continuing to grow in so many program areas and expand and invest in the lives of kids, and we appreciate the investment that the community makes back in us.
Amy, how much are you hoping to raise with the Festival of Trees?
We're hoping to raise about $240,000 at the event. We think we can do it this year. Our corporate sponsors have been so generous to us in advance that we're off to a really good start before the event has even begun. So it's a very special community bonding experience, and we're grateful to all the people who come out, to all the people who sponsor us, to the people who decide to buy their Christmas decorations there for children. We love you all.
This town is known for a lot of generosity. Mm-hmm. So are the corporate sponsors really bullish on the Baby Fold?
I think they feel very positively about the fact that they can trust us to do wonderful things with their money that will ultimately benefit the economy and create good future employees for all of them. I think they understand the investment that we're making in the future, and we are creating the friends, the neighbors, and the future employees of tomorrow, and they understand that.
In addition to the Festival of Trees, mm-hmm. you have something called a Christmas wish list.
Oh, we do. And that happens right after the Festival of Trees. If you would like to adopt one of our child's Christmas wish lists, please contact us through our website or at thebabyfold.org, and we can send you a list of a child, and then we'll have a drop-off site where you can come and give us those gifts. No need to wrap them or anything, but what we really try to do is serve kids who would typically not have anything under their tree for Christmas. And last year we were able to fill about 600 lists with the community's help, and we were so grateful for that. It's a very special thing. We feel like we're in Santa's workshop when families start dropping off the toys and gifts. You know, these kids don't have very much, and so if we can make that day a little special for them, we really want to. We would like to see those smiles.
That's Amy Beam, Vice President of Development and Public Relations at the Baby Fold. The Festival of Trees is Friday through Sunday at the Interstate Center in Bloomington. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Winners of the Christmas tree auctions at the Festival of Trees are notified by text. Trees can then be picked up at the Interstate Center on Sunday. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from John Norton, Ryan Denham, and Laura Kennedy. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Charlie Schlenker.